Hello, and welcome to the Queen's Observatory Fast Radio Bursts. I am Connor Stone, here with my co-host, Nikhil Arora. It is our mission to bring exciting space news hot off the telescope and into your ears. One way or another, the Queen's Observatory has continued its practice of sharing the wonders of the universe since 1857. Thank you for joining us in this long-running tradition. It's a big universe to talk about, so let's get started.
Hello and welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. I'm your host, Nick Arora. Here with me is, just as always and just as excited, Connor. Connor, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Nick?
I am great, too. So we are back with another interview episode, however, with a twist. So if you've not heard by now, the Queen's Observatory is actually going on a hiatus for the foreseeable future. We hope to be back, but for now, we're shutting down our operations. So we thought, as an interview for the last episode of the podcast, for the time being, we'd go over some of the highlights. There's also an added twist, and that is that this is Connor and I's last, essentially, job requirement or last activity as Queen's Observatory coordinators. So the next time we open up, there you'll see newer faces. And therefore, I thought it'd be a good idea to go through what Connor and I have sort of done or had taken part in with the observatory, our scientific careers, and what comes next for us. So that's the idea for this interview. How do you feel about it, Connor?
It's a good twist. We're going to interview ourselves this time.
Exactly. So I'm going to start out as the interviewer, and I'm going to interview Connor. And then we're going to switch, and Connor's going to do the same thing. But before we talk about our science and what's next for us, we thought it'd be a good idea for us to actually go over some of the activities that Connor and I have brought together, took part in, when it comes to, as associated with the Queen's Observatory, as the Queen's Observatory coordinators. So maybe here are some of our highlights. And we should start with sort of what used to be the main show of the observatory, the open house. Of course, since the pandemic, we've not had the open house, and we've had sort of response to the pandemic and some replacements for it. But we should talk about the open house. So, Connor, talk me and our audience, rather, through what changes or what updates did you bring to the open houses back when they used to happen?
Right. So the open house, the basic idea was it was an opportunity for anyone to come and see the Queen's Observatory telescope in the dome and look at something in space, assuming, fingers crossed, it wasn't cloudy. So the main program of the observatory open houses was traditionally to have a 20-minute talk by an astronomer that would explain something interesting going on in the night sky. And then we would bring people up in groups to see the observatory, but only 25 people at a time could be at the observatory. So we actually had three stations, and one of them was in what's called the warm room, which is always cold, just below the observatory. One of them was just out on the roof where the Royal Astronomical Society Kingston chapter would set up some of their own telescopes so that people could see a variety of different objects. And then, of course, there was the observatory station itself, where we would let people look through our big 14-inch telescope. Yeah. So that was the sort of original open house program that I kind of came into at the start, sometime in 2017, I think.
Yeah, it's been a while, I'd say. Yeah, but yeah, you've got that right. About summer of 2017. You're about right. Yeah. Okay. So, I think one of the things that's important that sort of changed was the viewership of the open house, right, Connor? I think that sort of increased, and that was a good thing for us. And what do you think were the reasons for that?
Well, so to begin with, the observatory would get somewhere around 50 to 70 participants joining in each month, which is great. It was a big outreach program for campus. But over time, we had a string of good weather and a lot of really great speakers. And I think we encouraged more and more people to come.
Yeah.
And as the program grew, it kind of snowballed. So we realized that we had so many people, we needed to make more than just three stations. So we ended up creating 6 different science stations, each one with something interesting to show people. And more people came as we expanded the program and made it a bigger event to come to. By the time the pandemic hit, we were regularly over 100 people coming every month, and we quite often got up higher, 150 or 200 people in a single night, which was really exciting to see how much enthusiasm the Kingston community and surrounding areas had for the observatory.
Certainly, yeah. And one of the cool things was that this was, the crowd was a variation of ages. You'd have really kids from 4, 5, 6 years old, all the way up to like 60, 70 year old people come up and interact with us, which was really cool. We didn't have a hole in age range, which was rare.
Yeah, had a lot of families, but also enthusiasts of all ages, a lot of students, of course, because we're on campus. So that actually created some logistical interesting challenges, because of course, younger kids, you don't want them to be up until 11 p.m.
Yeah.
in order to see the observatory. So we had to find ways to get them up to the telescope quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was the open house. So another great thing about the Queen's Observatory was sort of its reach into the school system within Kingston and nearby regions. School tours would, school kids would actually come during the day for visits to the observatory. And before the pandemic, these kids would come interact with either Connor or I as the Queen's Observatory coordinator and go up to the telescope, see the telescope, but also because these were during the day, they'd get to see the solar, play around with the solar telescope that we have. So get to see the sun. We also were collaborating with the Miller Museum here for geology as well. So it would be a joint tour where they'd visit the Queen's Observatory and also the Miller Museum here at Queen's Observatory. Of course, because of the pandemic, we couldn't really have in-person tours. So we made some changes to that program as well. Connor, guide us through what those were like.
Right. So the school tours were a really important part of the observatory mandate. We were connecting with schools all around the Kingston area and getting students excited about astronomy.
Yeah.
So we still wanted to accomplish that goal, but obviously we couldn't do it in person. What we ended up coming up with is a program where the students would go through Zoom or some other video conferencing software and join us as we showed our computer screen that had a sky simulating software on it. It's called Stellarium, and it lets you sort of visualize what the sky would look like anywhere on Earth and at any time. So what we could do is accelerate through time, show students the night sky and how the night sky changes over time. We can show lots of different events that occur, such as solar eclipses, but also we could explain to the students how they can use this program, which is free, to learn more about the night sky, either by just using a pair of binoculars. There's a number of interesting nebulae and galaxies that can be seen just with a pair of binoculars. And we also showed some of the indigenous knowledge that's contained in Stellarium, where you can learn about different constellations and sky stories from all around the world.
Yeah. And we also kind of sort of collaborated with these school tours with Let's Talk Science as well. There was an element of this organization which runs across Canada called Let's Talk Science, where we actually worked with the Kingston chapter of it and essentially generated an activity where students got to appreciate how big the solar system actually is. So basically, they tried to make their own pocket solar system with just a string and a few beads, and they got to appreciate that it's actually ginormous, if I can put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the challenges of a Zoom tour is that it's not very interactive.
Yeah.
The students are effectively just sitting there, and some of the more bold students will chime up and ask a question.
Yeah.
But obviously, when you're working with K through 12, which we did the full gamut of K through 12, and even some university students with our tours, we wanted to give them something a little more active to engage with. And that's really what the pocket solar system activity allowed them to do. They could work with their hands and make something that would help them understand space a little better.
Yeah. All right, so let's continue to move on. The next one that we have that came up just before the pandemic actually happened was Astronomy on Tap Kingston. Astronomy on Tap essentially sort of was motivated by the idea that we want to have a casual environment where scientists and public can talk, but at the same time, maximize that interaction. That was the idea. So we put, initially we started out putting these events in bars. So the Mansion here in Kingston or the Kingston Brew Pub got a few of the events. And the idea was to bring as many scientists, be it professors, be it grad students, into a room and let them have essentially one-on-one interactions with people about anything they want to talk about. We, of course, had a theme attached to it, but anything they want to talk about space-related, and get their questions answered over a pint of beer. So that was the idea. Unfortunately, I think we were only able to do 5 or 6 events before the pandemic actually happened. So we had to stop. We did switch over to a more a live stream version where we stream these shows now on YouTube, where we bring 3 scientists together and they have a chat. They give a talk and then they have a chat amongst each other. So that's the idea. It was a lot of fun when we were actually going in person. We do plan on coming back in person, but we're still trying to figure that out, of course, as you can imagine. So next up was our biggest response, I would say, our major response to the pandemic, and that was this podcast, Connor, the Fast Radio Burst. Let's sort of guide people through what was the idea behind the Fast Radio Burst. So what kind of episodes were we putting forward here? I mean, their listeners, they are pretty well known, but let's try to put our vision and our motivation to the kind of episodes that we're putting.
Right. So the Fast Radio Bursts, as we explained in the first episode, kind of comes from the name of this mysterious astronomy phenomenon, which comes in really quick and gives us lots of insight into how the universe works.
Yep.
And that's kind of what we wanted to do with the podcast, of course, is we wanted a medium that was ideal for the new way that the observatory was going to have to interact with people. We couldn't interact with them in person. We tried posting material online, like on a YouTube during a live stream, but we ran into the issue that on the internet, people don't want to come to a very specific event at a specific time.
Yeah.
And be very interactive. So what the podcast allowed us to do was to present material that people could then access on their own time in a way that's convenient for them. And so the podcast let us do that. And as we sort of grew into the podcast format, we realized that it allowed us to achieve a lot of depth that we otherwise couldn't in certain other mediums. So what we were able to do is the split between our science episodes and our interview episodes, where the science episodes would let us sort of dive deep into a topic over the course of like 30 minutes or several 30-minute episodes, yeah, which you wouldn't really very often do if you were talking to someone in person. There's very few people who will just sit there and listen to you talk for 30 minutes or several hours.
We can talk, but people won't want to listen to us.
Yeah, exactly. But if you download the podcast, then that's what you'll get, is basically us talking for as long as we can about a topic. Yeah. So that was really good for the science episodes. And another thing that the podcast allowed us to do that we wouldn't otherwise have been able to do was our interview series, where we actually got to learn about the astronomy that's being done in the Queen's Astronomy Department, and learn in detail what all of these different scientists are doing here at the astronomy department. And that as well, we probably wouldn't have been able to do very well in an in-person event. So we tried really to embrace the podcast medium and do with it what we could, and not try and just replace our open houses with something as close as we could get to that.
Yeah.
We wanted to really do the best that we could in the medium that we had to work with.
Yeah. Absolutely. Maybe I'll give some stats about the podcast, I think. So we, including this episode, will have about 35 episodes. So in about 2 years, we've hit 35 episodes. And about 2,000 individual downloads have happened. So that's about 60 people per episode. That's what we would get. As you can imagine, given that we're here at Queens in Canada, our viewership is predominantly North American. Most people in North America listen to us. But there are about 15% of our listeners do come from Europe, which is the second highest listenership, if I can put it that way. At all time, we've had downloads from all continents except Antarctica. Unfortunately, penguins are not that interested in astronomy. Sucks. And at one point, we were the fifth most popular astronomy show here in Canada in a podcast medium, which I think is quite a cool thing, we'd say. Connor, do you want to sort of give us some insight into what our most popular episodes were, both an interview or a science interview?
Yeah, so our most popular episode for the interviews was actually one of our first interviews. Yeah. It was with Akanksha.
Yeah.
And we were looking at the Crab Pulsar.
Yeah.
And Akanksha is, of course, a great speaker, and she was our first interview. So it kind of makes sense that one is where we've had most of our viewership.
Yeah.
I imagine that a lot of people, by the time they get to Akanksha's interview, they sort of understand what the Fast Radio Bursts is, and then they may pick and choose from other podcasts on what seems interesting to them.
Right.
And so they can scatter around, because of course all the podcasts are sort of independent unless it's part of a series, and those are really clearly demarcated.
Yeah.
And then our most popular science ultra fast radio burst episode would be the Earth Extermination, which just by the name you can tell it's going to catch the eyeballs. That was part of our series of like how to destroy the universe.
Yeah.
And it was a really fun series where we talked about sort of ridiculous ways that one could go about destroying various grand things in the universe.
Yep.
That
including the universe,
including the whole universe itself. And we had a lot of fun with that, talking about some of the science that goes into these cataclysmic events that happen in space all the time. And then at the end, we always finished off with some ridiculous way that a mega project by humans could probably achieve the same result.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was our podcast. Connor, if you had to pick, and now I'm putting you on the spot. This is not, we didn't think about it, but if you had to pick an episode from the podcast, which one would you say people should listen to for sure?
An episode that people should listen to.
Or an UltraFast series, yeah.
Okay. See, it's really hard to pick just one, and for the interviews, I have to say I'm not going to pick an interview because I really liked all of the interviews.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go for one of the science episodes.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the most fun ones for me to do, excluding the Dangerous Universe series because we've already talked about that, was the Living Universe series, the Great Filters episode, which came across as a big list,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
But it was so much fun to research that one and learn about all of the crazy ways that people have envisioned how life could exist and in some way not be detectable by us yet.
Right.
And the incredible creativity there really, really got me excited. And also the fact that a lot of it, anyone could do if they just sort of sat down and thought very hard about how life could exist.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really accessible, really fun, and really creative the whole way through.
Cool. For me, I think my favorite episode goes back to like one of the first episodes we did, and that was the Black Hole Collision. I mean, everybody knows this by now. It's all about black holes for me. And I think just what I learned while working on that episode and also just the news that it was made it very exciting and made it into some cool science. So I think that was a great episode for me, for sure. All right. Even though I would like to continue to talk about just this podcast, we have to move on. And towards the end of the segment, before we take a break, we do want to talk about some of the things that are still actually living on, even though we're going on a break. We do have some let's say, bleed over events that are working on, that we are working towards and that will happen. One of them is Science Rendezvous. Science Rendezvous is this big event that happens once a year in Kingston that brings all kinds of science that is available here in Kingston to one place, which is the Leon Center. And just people get to experience that. And we get a huge turnout of people. And that's going to be the case. It's partly, as far as I understand, Connor, it's partly remote, part in person. I'm going to give Connor, you're going to explain the remote part to us as well. But yeah, it's happening on May 7th at the Leon Center. So if you're in Kingston, in and around Kingston, do come check us out. We are going to be there as the Queen's Observatory. What are we going to have, Connor, at the Science Rendezvous event?
Right. So we've tried to prepare for a full like wave of people.
Yeah.
The round before the pandemic, we had 5,000 people come to a Science Rendezvous. So we really wanted to put on a big show. What we will have there is a series of telescopes that you can use to look at the sun. So we're fingers crossed for a sunny day, and we'll get to see a really active and exciting sun right now because it's during a solar maximum. So that's one of our big attractions, is that you can look at the sun safely at our station. We will also have some eclipse demos. So in 2024, there will be an eclipse passing right through Kingston. And we want to get people as prepared for this as possible. So we're going to have several demos that demonstrate what an eclipse is and how it works, and also how to view it safely. So there's going to be a lot of information there for people who are interested in this eclipse. And if we know anything from the most recent Great American Eclipse, everyone's interested in this. So we want to be fully prepared. It's going to happen in a couple of years, which sounds like a long time, but it'll go fast. And we want everyone to be ready for that. Finally, we will have a solar system walk. So you will be able to get a passport from us. And this passport will have a spot for each planet. And when you go through the solar system walk, which will actually be a full walk of Tragically Hip Way, where it'll be a two-scale model of the solar system.
Right.
You can get a stamp at each station and bring it back to us for a little prize. So you'll be able to learn about the solar system, because at each station we'll have information about that planet. And you'll also get to see to scale what the size of the solar system is. And if we know anything from the pocket solar system activity, it's really surprising when you get to see it all.
I didn't want to say it. I want people to be surprised, but I was like, oh, should I say it? Should I not say it? Yes, it's going to be very surprising when you find out.
Yes, so I'm not going to tell you what it is, but you'll see when you get there.
All right. There's also another thing involved at Science Rendezvous, and that is Sky Stories. So tell us a little bit about Sky Stories. Who is involved? What are you doing there? Yeah.
Right. So this is a part of the online element of Science Rendezvous. And last year for Science Rendezvous, I did one of our virtual Stellarium tours, as if it was for one of the school tours, but this was for everyone at Science Rendezvous. We had a huge turnout for that. And one of the elements that people really got excited about was the fact that I was able to show in Stellarium constellations from a bunch of other cultures. Now, what we wanted to do was sort of dive in a little deeper with that. And so there will be a online element that is Sky Stories as presented by some people from these indigenous cultures.
Nice.
Which I'm pretty excited about. I will also be doing another Stellarium tour. So definitely check those out, and a whole bunch of other really cool science talks that will be part of the virtual part of Let's Talk Science, of Science Rendezvous.
Right. Yes.
I mean, Let's Talk Science will be there too.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's cool. All right. Once again, I think this segment has been putting Connor on the spot. So let's continue that theme. Connor, come up. Could you tell us one of the highlights that you have had with the Queen's Observatory in your tenure in the last 4 or 5 odd years?
One of the highlights. I'm going to have to do multiple highlights because you're putting me on the spot.
All right, maybe keep it down to three.
So one of the highlights for me was, as the observatory coordinator, I was organizing Observatory open houses. And as part of the open houses, something that I started was recording the open houses. So for a while, we live streamed them. We learned that that was difficult. So we started recording them and posting them up on YouTube. And one of the people, I won't say who, one of the people who had their presentation recorded later got offered a position, in part because of that recording that really impressed the interviewers.
Wow.
So when they told me about that, I was super excited. I was really proud of the Observatory for having a positive impact on someone's career like that.
Yeah.
And they did a good job, so they deserved it. Another one I think was a real highlight for me was Art McDonald's talk.
Right.
So Art McDonald, Nobel laureate from Queen's University. Of course, we wanted to roll out the red carpet and make this a big event and get people really excited. So we actually booked a different room than normal. We've planned a huge amount of activities. And then the day came and it was the worst blizzard of the entire year.
Oh, yeah.
It was a truly awful evening. Yep. And I was kind of devastated going into that. I was thinking like we would get a few people, like the dozen people coming out to see this Nobel laureate, and we would have wasted his time. Yeah. Art McDonald's super nice, so he wouldn't have said anything anyway. He would have totally done it. But instead, we had almost 200 people come out.
Yeah.
The night was a huge success. We didn't get to see anything in space, but we still got to show people the observatory and how it worked. Art McDonald got to give an excellent talk about neutrinos and how we can use these ghostly particles to learn about space. So the night went off perfectly. We probably could have got bigger numbers if it was a nice night, but really a huge number of people showed up, and I had a great time. And then afterwards I had a lot of beer because because I was really happy that it worked out.
I did not know you were going to mention that. Cool. all right. I guess for me, there are a couple of events as well. I'll do one pre-pandemic and one post-pandemic for sure. I think Astronomy on Tap, as I've pointed out, that was kind of an important addition to the Queen's Observatory for sure. So the first event of Astronomy on Tap being a sold out kind of event where we filled out. It was at the NOG. The Ternanog was a great idea. We've of course changed how we do Astronomy on Tap since the first event, but I was quite happy about that being an event here in Kingston and having such a success as an event for sure. So that was a lot of fun. And then of course some of the chats that you have at the Astronomy on Tap event over a beer were certainly a lot of fun. Secondly, I think one post-pandemic, which I did not expect to go as well, but it actually had an amazing turnout, was the Mars rover landing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I really thought it's going to be the regular crowd that comes to us for the Queen's Observatory who is going to watch this live stream. But it ended up being about close to 1,000 people who watched that stream. And yeah, so we had people from really across Queens and beyond Queens, because we had speakers from Arizona who were talking about what it means to actually make the rover. And then we had people here in Canada who were experts in launching things and having things walk or run on extraterrestrial surfaces, talk to us about what it means to actually send us a rover. And then, of course, I still remember the land going successfully, the NASA stream that we were showing, and nearly all of us just jumped into the out of our chairs because of that. I think that was definitely one of the highlights, certainly for us. Yeah. Okay. So I guess this brings us for a good break time here. And when we come back, we're going to go into a little bit of science and see what Connor and I have been doing apart from outreach and what we continued. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. We are interviewing each other, as you might have noticed. So yeah, we've talked about some of the observatory highlights that we've had in our tenure as the observatory coordinators. We're now going to move on to science. And I think it was the same thing as Galaxies episode, Connor. I think we said to each other, we don't need an invitation to talk about our science.
Yeah.
But we still need to be brief about it. So Connor, let's try to do that.
Yeah, I'll try.
Exactly. Let's try to be brief about it. Okay. So yeah, Connor, tell us in the 4 years of your PhD or 6 years, PhD plus master's, what was the essence of your thesis? What did you want to accomplish? Or rather, as people point out, give us the elevator pitch.
The elevator pitch. Yeah. All right. So the elevator pitch for my research was really, I wanted to drill down and understand some of the complexity that is entailed in galaxies. So galaxies, we've all seen beautiful pictures from Hubble, and there's all sorts of different shapes that they take. In fact, most of the pictures that Hubble shows are of a specific type of really pretty galaxy, but there's lots of variety out there. And there are some that are quite boring by comparison visually, but they're very interesting in terms of their mechanics and how they work. So I wanted to do a better job of explaining the complexity that is the full population of galaxies.
Okay, that's great. Okay, you really made it an elevator pitch. Good on you, Connor. I thought you were going to go.
Well, I was told to do an elevator pitch. I could go on for longer.
I was assuming you're going to be just like any other scientist, where an elevator pitch is going to be about 10 minutes. Great. Okay, so yeah, you had multiple elements to that. One of them was actually writing a software that's called AutoProof. So lead us through what AutoProof was.
Right. So before you can understand the range of properties that galaxies have, you of course need to turn them into usable data. So one of the key elements of turning galaxy images into data is this software that I've created, AutoProof. There's a variety of other softwares, but there's certain ways that mine's better. So you can imagine you get this beautiful picture from Hubble or some other telescope. A lot of my analysis in particular used a certain survey called the Desi Legacy Imaging Survey. And so you have this image of a galaxy, and it's just a bunch of pixels. Each pixel tells you how bright it is. And you want to convert all of these pixels into some knowledge about the galaxy. How big is it? How bright is it? What color is it? You need to know these kinds of quantities, not, oh, pixel 7,255 by 2,521 is at a flux value of 0.76.
Right.
That's not very interesting. So what AutoProof does is it assumes that if the galaxy had been face on when we took its picture, it would be a perfect circle. But of course, we don't get to choose where the galaxies are in space. So they're tilted at some degree to us. And that tilt turns the circle that it would be face on into an ellipse. And so what AutoProof does is it tries to create an ellipse which matches that image of the galaxy. And it does this a whole bunch of times from the center of the galaxy all the way out to the edge. And once we've done that, we can actually measure what's called the surface brightness profile, where you can essentially say, how bright is the galaxy as I go further and further out from the center? So the center is going to be very bright. It's super concentrated with tons of stars, very packed in close together. And as you go further and further out from the center of the galaxy, it'll get dimmer and dimmer because there's fewer stars lighting it up. So AutoProof is what actually quantifies that relationship. And then there's some pretty, once you've got that, there's some pretty basic math you can do to determine what the total amount of light in that galaxy is, what the size of the galaxy is, what color it is. All of these things that you'd be interested in about that galaxy, you can turn them into hard numbers now and start to compare between galaxies. So that's what AutoProof accomplishes.
Cool. That's interesting, Connor. So what is the, how long does it take to process a galaxy? And as you pointed out, it is actually better than other.
yeah, how, so I should probably mention that.
How is it better than others?
Right. So for a typical galaxy that I was looking at, it would take somewhere around 30 seconds
right.
to go from the raw image to the final condensed surface brightness profile. Its speed was on the better end of average. So it took a similar amount of time to other programs, but was maybe a touch faster, if I can say, with my totally unbiased opinion. And what it really accomplished that was a step up, though, was how robust it was and how deep it could go. And by that, I mean, galaxies never come to us pure and clean. There's complicated things going on in the galaxy. There may be another galaxy nearby overlapping with it, or there may be stars nearby in the image that are shining right beside that galaxy. And a lot of algorithms will get confused by this, and they won't know, well, they're fitting their ellipse, but they won't know whether to match it to the galaxy we want or to match it to the other galaxy. And things can get really twisted up and mangled.
Right.
AutoProf doesn't do that because of a few clever algorithms that involve Fourier transforms, and I'm not going to go into that.
Big word.
So I'm not going to do that. But another thing that it does is it goes deeper, which means that when it's measuring the image, a lot of algorithms would stop where the noise starts to get too high.
Yeah.
For my code, it can actually go a little further than other ones, about 10 times fainter into the noise, because it uses some clever averaging in order to lump multiple pixels together and add to the signal to noise and get down to fainter things.
Nice. Cool. All right. Okay. So let's move on to the next part of your work. And that was the probe sample. What was it? What is it? One thing I should say, caution, is I know Connor's work very well because he, A, is my office mate, B, he works in the same research group as me, and C, we actually, as you can see, collaborate a lot. Essentially, barring maybe one or two papers, Connor and I have written a lot of papers with each other. We are co-authors on each other's papers. So yeah, we are very close in our works. So if it looks like I know things, it's just because we work very close. Probe sample, yes. Moving on.
It sounds like you know because you do know.
Yeah.
Yes. So the probe sample, it probes is our acronym for photometry and rotation curve observations from extragalactic surveys. And no, the acronym doesn't quite work, but that's how astronomy does things. And what all of those words combine to mean is that I have a collection of galaxies, about 1,500 to 2,000, depending on how selective you are about how good those galaxy measurements are.
Yeah.
So I have a couple thousand galaxies where for each one I have the AutoProf data for those galaxies. So I've run AutoProf on images of those galaxies in multiple wavelengths. So you get that color information. And I also have what's called a rotation curve. And a rotation curve is just how fast that galaxy is spinning. So a lot of galaxies are disks. You can imagine like a plate spinning on the end of your finger.
Yeah.
They're kind of like that, although maybe a little more like a whirlpool swirling around, because some parts are spinning faster than others.
Yeah.
So yeah, galaxies are all swirling around their center, and we've got measurements of how quickly they're swirling around, which is super useful because the majority of a galaxy is actually made up of dark matter that we can't see, but its gravity does affect how quickly things spin around.
Yeah.
It's just like our solar system. The gravity of the sun is what determines how fast the Earth has to move around, something like 30 kilometers per second. If the sun was heavier, it would have to move faster. And we would conclude that there is dark matter in our solar system if it was moving faster than it is. So that's what the probe sample is. It's a collection of galaxies where I have this information about the light from those galaxies and the rotation, which by extension gives me mass, dark matter, interesting stuff like that.
Right. Cool. So you combined AutoProf and probes to build up what we are calling intrinsic scatter. Of course, that's a big word, guys, but Connor's going to break it down here. So tell us about the intrinsic scatter.
Right. So kind of the culmination of my research. AutoProf let me look at the light in a galaxy. Probes let me match up the light and the rotation for a whole bunch of galaxies. And now the intrinsic scatter, I was looking at what are called scaling relations. So a scaling relation is what happens when you place two quantities about a galaxy next to each other and create a correlation. So the total amount of light in a galaxy and the speed that it's rotating at. You can make a plot that shows those two against each other, which has a nice strong correlation. The brighter the galaxy is, the faster it rotates. And by extension, the more mass it has, which mostly makes sense, right? A brighter galaxy is also a more massive galaxy.
Right.
Another example is a brighter galaxy is also bigger. So there's a size-luminosity relationship. And these relationships, turns out there's a lot of them. I did 9 different parameters and all combinations of them, which is about 36 different correlations. And in every single combination of two parameters, there is a correlation that would span multiple orders of magnitude or powers of 10. So galaxies that are as disparate from each other in mass as a mouse is compared to a house. Like if you wanted to compare the properties of a house and the properties of a mouse, and you found out that they actually lined up really well and matched up with each other, you would be equally as amazed as astronomers are looking at these properties of galaxies, which by relative comparison are equally different and yet follow the same patterns,
right?
Which I think is super cool. But people have already studied this. They've actually been studying it for decades and looked at these trends.
Yeah.
So I decided to go one layer further and look at the scatter around these relations. So although there is a nice correlation between them, between any pair of parameters, it's not perfect. There's still some variability around it. And the problem with astronomy is that everything you're looking at is really, really faint. So even when we do our best job with a big telescope that's as big as like your living room for its mirror, when that collects light, focuses it all together and gets an image of a galaxy, it's still noisy. There's still errors in those measurements. So the question becomes, around these nice trends that we see spanning over such a large range, how much of that variability around the trend is because of just the noise in our measurements and the fact that everything's really faint? And how much of it is because of the actual differences among galaxies? So I like to say the better word for intrinsic scatter is diversity. Mm. So just like there are tall people and short people, despite there being an average height, there are big galaxies and small galaxies more than you would expect given its properties. So that change of big and small galaxies, that variability, what we see as the variability is partly because of our errors, partly because of the actual variability. For this paper, my intrinsic scatter paper, I actually developed a Bayesian algorithm which could analyze the errors and subtract them and drill down at what is the true variability among the galaxies. And when I did that, I actually found out that the dozens of studies that had come before me and had tried to estimate this parameter had actually got it a little bit wrong. There was actually slightly more diversity among the galaxies than people had originally assumed, which now means, okay, where's that diversity coming from? What is causing these galaxies to change from the normal relation? And that's a question for simulators and people who come up with models of galaxies and try to understand what it is that makes them grow and evolve. So there's more work to be done on like where this extra diversity is coming from, but that's sort of what came out of that analysis,
right?
Was there's lots of variability out there.
All right, cool. So you hinted towards the future. So I guess it makes sense to talk about the future. So Connor, what is next for you,
Pat? So next for me is sort of a bunch of different things. I'm headed to Montreal, and there I will be doing what's called a postdoc. It's sort of a job between your graduate studies and a faculty position. The hope is that I will be a professor, but it takes a while to apply to be a professor. So while I'm doing that, I work as a postdoc. And the group that I'm working with is this really cool group that works on strong lensing of galaxies. It's these chance alignments where two galaxies line up with each other, and the gravity from one, thanks to Einstein, bends the light from the other one, and you get this weird warped image of that galaxy. Turns out there's a lot you can learn from that warped image, because it tells you about the mass in the galaxy that's in front, and you can actually, it magnifies the galaxy that's behind it, so you can see it brighter than you otherwise would have. So there's a lot of interesting things you can learn about galaxies from these images that show bent light around other galaxies. As well as that, I'll be, of course, continuing my intrinsic scatter analysis, and I want to look at how this intrinsic scatter or diversity changes as the universe evolves. I looked at a bunch of galaxies that are nearby, basically as old as the Milky Way is. But if we look further out in space, what we see is back in time. And so I'll be able to look at galaxies at different times and figure out if the diversity has been changing over time.
Cool. So that's exciting.
Yeah.
All right. I guess we'll take another break over here. And when we come back, we will switch roles, I guess.
I get to interview you this time.
Yep. We'll be right back.
And welcome back. I have taken over Nick as the interviewer, and I am now in charge of the rest of the episode. So, we've talked about the observatory. We've talked a bit about my research. It's time now to put Nick in the hot seat and ask him about what he's done for the last 6 years, because he's been working very hard also to understand galaxies, but from a quite different perspective than myself. We've sort of worked together on so many different things. And Nick, now why don't you tell us the elevator pitch for your research?
All right, great. By the way, before I start, I will say it's a little trippy to switch hosts like this in the middle of the show. I will say my brain just went a little haywire. But okay, let's start. So my job, my PhD is basically trying to answer the best way I can tell is, what don't we know about astronomy or about galaxies? The idea over here is we have observations, which are the real universe, and then we have simulations that Connor hinted to while he was talking about, which kind of represent the best replication of what we know. It kind of brings us to, here's what we know about galaxies, and here's how they should look. But the problem that pops in is our simulations, which represent our understanding, our knowledge set of galaxies, does not always match real galaxies. And so then the question really becomes is, what are we missing? What don't we know? And that's where my PhD comes in. My PhD comes in sort of tying observations of galaxies through telescopes and simulations, which are run on supercomputers, together to say, hey, guys, who are using telescopes, do this a little differently. And hey, guys who are using simulations, this might be the better way to go about this problem. So that's sort of the idea of my PhD.
All right. Ding. Elevator has finished. And we now know a little bit about what your research has been for the last few years. Now, just like me, your research has been broken up into a few very dedicated papers. Yeah. So let's start with the MANGA sample. What is that? And what did you do with it?
Okay, so MANGA is an acronym in astronomy. Of course, it's not that great an acronym, but we're going to spell it out anyways. MANGA stands for Mapping the Nearby Galaxies at Apache Point Observatory. Apache Point Observatory is a telescope that is in New Mexico at the Apache Point. And it's one of the more famous telescopes in astronomy. It's the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Unlike regular telescopes, which you tell the telescope where to point, the sky survey telescopes essentially look at the whole sky multiple times over. So that's what MANGA is. MANGA is a special kind of survey, which is looking at the full sky. So the idea is to collect a sample of about 10,000 galaxies, which would be the biggest that we have today. So just as a reference, remember Connor's probe sample has about 2,000 galaxies. So Manga, in its essence, is trying to collect more than that. And it has a special twist to it. So we can observe galaxies with it for two ways. We could either take a picture of it, which is just basically taking out your camera and taking a picture of the galaxy, or we can take the light that's coming from the galaxy and take the picture of the rainbow that the galaxy forms. So basically put a prism in between and split the light into the rainbow, and see how different colors of light within the galaxy behave. So what Manga is trying to do is it's trying to do both these things together. So for every pixel, it's trying to take the rainbow of the light for every pixel. So that makes what is what we call an integral field unit or integral field spectroscopy. Big term, but basically what it gives us is at the same time, it gives us an idea of what the light is and how fast the galaxy is moving. But along with that, you get many other things for which you'll have to go and make individual observations. So you get what kind of chemicals are involved in galaxies and how long has stars in the galaxy been alive or how fast the galaxy is forming stars. How is the black hole working at the center of the galaxy? So that's Manga. What I have done for Manga is basically, remember Connor's autoprof technique. My job is to provide the biggest photometric, which is the light sample, and the dynamical sample for Manga. So I've taken Connor's autoprof, basically, and applied it to the full Manga sample to get one of the most robust catalogs of the light distribution within Manga galaxies. So about 9,000 galaxies, we have very high quality light distributions, light profiles, as we call them, for these galaxies. Not only that, these light profiles are available in multiple wavelengths. So not only just the optical parts, so your regular green, red, and near infrared, but these light profiles are also available for mid-infrared bands and also the UV, the ultraviolet. Then the second part of the Manga sample is the dynamical catalog, which is basically taking the Manga IF Manga data and seeing how fast are the stars moving as we go further and further away from the galaxy, from the center of the galaxy. So those are called rotation curves. Those are essentially what Connor was talking about, prove dark matter exists in galaxies. So for all Manga galaxies, I have now compiled a set of rotation curves. Then there's also a third thing I've done, and that is it's a big question in astronomy. It's also a question amongst human beings as well. And that is, what is important, nature or nurture? When it comes to evolution of galaxies, what is important? Just the physics that the universe works in? Or is it also important to really understand the kind of environment the galaxies grow in? So galaxies come in various kinds of environments. You can have just lonely galaxies, which are just sitting there without any neighbors at all. You could have what is the Milky Way, which lives in a group. So you have Andromeda nearby and a couple of smaller galaxies around it. And those galaxies living in groups evolve differently. And then you have clusters of galaxies, which are thousands of galaxies essentially evolving together. And so the question worth asking is the physics for the lonely galaxy the same as the physics of the cluster galaxy? And for that, you actually need an idea of what kind of environment these galaxies live in. So for these Manga galaxies, I've also come up with a description for how to define an environment for these galaxies and then compile the full catalog of these Manga galaxies.
So you were quite busy with that.
Indeed.
With that bit of data. The Manga is a very rich data set. And I think the sense that everyone listening is going to get is that there's a lot of work to do on it and with it.
Yeah, certainly.
So that's certainly what you accomplished there.
Yeah.
Now that is in an example of observed data where some telescope has looked at the sky and got us some light that really came from some stars. But as you explained in your elevator pitch, your research really exists at the boundary between observations and simulations.
Yeah.
So the next thing I got to ask you about is NIHAO.
Yes.
And I'm not saying hi. That's an acronym. So what is it? What is it and what did you do with it?
Yeah, NIHAO stands for Numerical Investigation of 100 Astrophysical Objects. So it's a simulation. Basically, what you want to do is you want to take the basics of galaxies, which are essentially dark matter, gas, and stars, and put them together in a box and let them work with the physics that we know and output a galaxy at the end. That's what a Nihao is. That's what Nihao is. Nihao is essentially a bunch of math equations that are running on a computer, and you give it a bunch of dark matter particles and a bunch of gas particles, and in the end, it will give you something like the Milky Way, let's say. And so that's what Nihao is. The idea where Nihao fits in my research is understanding how well does Nihao do reproducing the manga sample. Manga is one of the best samples that we have today. It is one of the more richest samples that we have today. It's up to date. It's robust. Can Nihao, which is producing galaxies based on what we know so far about galaxy formation and evolution, reproduce manga samples? And so that's the idea. And so to do this, I use the same thing that Connor was talking about earlier, which was scaling relations. The idea is these scaling relations essentially capture, have sort of ingrained in them, the physics that is dictating various properties of galaxies. So for example, we can over here take velocities, and we've talked about how velocities tell us about dark matter in galaxies, and we can take the mass in stars, which tells you how fast a galaxy would form stars or how efficiently a galaxy is converting gas into stars. So if at the end of the day, if we make a correlation out of velocities and stars, which is a popular correlation in astronomy, does the one seen in manga get close enough to the one seen in Nihao? That's the idea. And if we are able to reproduce the Nihao, the mass velocity relation here with Nihao, we say three things about our understanding of galaxy formation. We say we reproduce the amount of dark matter in galaxies and the amount of stars in galaxies. And B, we actually have a grasp of how efficiently stars are also being formed. Because bear in mind, the smaller the galaxy is, that is, the smaller the amount of dark matter within the galaxy is, the less stars it'll form, because there's just not enough gravity around. So that's what I've been working with Nihao.
All right. So you've really put together a really unique set in astronomy, yeah, of ways to connect observations and simulations. And what's interesting in astronomy is that the people who simulate galaxies don't always talk so much to the people who observe galaxies. And the people who observe galaxies don't always talk so much to the people who simulate galaxies. Yeah. Each one sort of builds up their own terminology, and it's very difficult, yeah, to bridge that gap.
Yeah.
That's really something that you've accomplished in your work, Nick, yeah, is being able to bridge that connection.
Yeah.
And that's what those first two manga and Nihao papers really,
yeah,
exemplify. So the next thing I've got to ask you about is one of your more recent ones,
yeah,
which is your local group analysis.
Right.
So what did you do with the local group, and what even is the local group?
Absolutely. So maybe I will start this with a preamble. One of the things that I keep on telling Connor when we talk about our future prospects and when we talk about our PhDs is one of the hardest things for me as a PhD, while writing my PhD, which is what Connor and I are doing right now, is to come up with a title for my PhD. What I have done over the past few number of years is essentially come up with interesting questions that I would like to answer and try to answer them. There hasn't been too much of a connection between these questions I've come up with. So coming up with an umbrella term for the PhD has been hard. So the local group is essentially an example of one of those projects. So as I was telling you before, the whole question about nature versus nurture in galaxy formation, which one is important, is what the local group tries to answer. So let's start with what is the local group. Well, local group is essentially the galaxies around Milky Way. Milky Way is our galaxy, and around it, we have a big friendly guy called the Andromeda Galaxy. And both Andromeda and Milky Way around them have smaller galaxies, what we call dwarf galaxies. And we've observed about 100 of those around. And so these 100 galaxies, along with Milky Way and Andromeda, form together what we call the local group of galaxies. This is our galactic neighborhood, and it's a good
idea. You can actually see some of them for yourself if you go down to the southern hemisphere, say, yeah, Australia.
Exactly.
On a dark night, you can see some of these dwarf galaxies. They're, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The
large Magellanic Cloud and the small Magellanic,
yeah,
Cloud.
The Magellanic Clouds, yeah, you can see down the southern. And so the question that this local group work is asking is, if I take one of these dwarf galaxies, like the Magellanic Clouds, that roams around Milky Way and Andromeda, and compare it with another dwarf galaxy that does not have Milky Way and Andromeda, how different are they? So that's the essence of this project. How different are smaller galaxies when they live alone and smaller galaxies when they have roommates? And the answer comes out to be surprising. The title of the paper was, is the local group unique? And the answer is, yes, it is unique, and no, it is not unique. And let me try and break that down. Why?
Classic scientist answer.
Exactly. Classic astronomy answer. Why is it like this? It is not unique because what we found was that local group dwarf galaxies, local group small galaxies, actually show about the same amount of star stellar content, or it's the same kinds of stars, that dwarf galaxies living alone would show. They're very similar. You could not distinguish them. However, they're special because dwarf galaxies in our cosmic neighborhood actually seem to have a different amount of gas, and B, different chemicals within the gas. It turns out there's a lot more metals. And when we say metal, we essentially mean anything that is not helium or hydrogen. And local group galaxies tend to have more metal gas. Now, there could be two reasons why that is. The first reason is, hey, I am sitting beside this big guy, Milky Way or Andromeda, and I'm just going to get gas from it. But there's another reason that can pop up from it. And that is just because they're around a big guy. They live in a dense environment. And that can give these dwarf galaxies in the local group extra gas metal content. And so which one is it? It turns out it's the second. So turns out our galaxy, the Milky Way, is not that special, which is always a hard thing to say because we live in it. But the Milky Way essentially shows the Milky Way Andromeda don't play a big role in the evolution of these smaller galaxies, which is a little surprising because these are big guys. And essentially the reason why the local group exists is because of the existence of these big guys. But at the end of the day, what Milky Way Andromeda provide is essentially the gravity in which 100 galaxies can come together and then co-evolve. But directly, there is no impact from the Milky Way onto these smaller galaxies. Yeah.
All right. So clearly, Nick, you've been involved in a lot of projects. As you said, you're going to have a hard time coming up with a title for your thesis. Yep. But you will do it at some point.
Oh, yes, right.
So what is next for you?
Yeah.
Once you're done?
Yeah. So, well, what's next for me in the near future is actually writing my thesis. That's what I'm continuing to do over the summer. And after I'm done with my thesis, I am headed to the United Arab Emirates. I am headed to New York University, Abu Dhabi, for a postdoc with the Nihao group. So I will now, for the next few years, will be working with the Nihao people closely, and I'll bring in my expertise of observations and over there cultivate my expertise that I have developed already to a bigger extent in simulations. So I'm going to continue working on comparing simulations and observations of galaxies, but I will get to work more closely with the Nihao people. Yeah, so that's what I'm doing.
Very exciting.
Maybe one thing that we can add sort of on the observational side is sort of keeping the legacy of Queen's University going between in what Connor and I do. And to that extent, we're coming up with what we're calling the Queen's Galaxy Catalog. It is going to be sort of my next step into observations, where we're going to take the idea of what probe sample was and make it 100 times bigger, essentially. So probes has about, what, 2,000 galaxies. We are planning to make a Queen's Galaxy Catalog, which will have about 500,000 galaxies in it, and all high quality, all robust, all that can be used as high quality data for simulators like me or people in Nihao Group to be able to compare with observations. Yeah.
Yeah. Should be really cool to have that many galaxies to look at.
Yeah.
People are often surprised by how many galaxies there are in the night sky, and 500,000 is only scratching the surface.
It's nothing.
There's still a long way to go,
yep.
But it's pretty big.
Yeah.
And yeah, so although I'm going to Montreal and Nick is going to the UAE,
yeah.
Science is really an international project. And so we will likely continue to collaborate with each other for years to come.
Yeah.
So I think that wraps it up for my interview of you.
Okay.
Nick. So I think we've now pretty much established a good final episode. We've got all the stuff that the observatory has done in the last few years. And what we've been doing for the last few years while also being the observatory coordinators. Obviously, it wasn't just us working in a vacuum for this last few years. There's a whole army of people to thank for the Queen's Observatory. We obviously couldn't have done this at all without the Queen's Physics Department, who really supported us the whole way through. The McDonald Institute did a lot of work to help expand what the observatory could do, and has worked alongside us for quite a while. The Royal Astronomical Society has been there from the beginning, from my very first open house as the coordinator. They've always been there to help out, to bring their own telescopes, to bring their expertise. And finally, but not least, there's been an incredible number of graduate students who were excited about astronomy, excited about sharing it with people all around the world. And these graduate students and faculty as well have really sort of made the observatory an event or a series of events. There's been so many different events that we've done. They've really made those happen by volunteering a lot of their time in order to run these science stations, in order to do these interviews, in order to do so many different things.
But I think more importantly, I think both Connor and I will resonate in this feeling. We also would like to thank our audience. Really, everything that we do is a result of the interest that our audience has shown. I mean, we can go anywhere from the open houses down to the podcast. None of it would be possible if you guys weren't there.
Yeah, certainly the enthusiasm that we've received and responses right from the beginning as well, the connection that we've had with so many people is really what makes it all worth it and really lets us know when we're doing a good job.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, thank you for being there in the last few years with us.
Yeah, so big thanks to everyone involved. And I think that's all for us from the Fast Radio Bursts. We hope to return better than ever once we're done this little hiatus. And until then, we're going to wish you all the best and clear skies.
Clear skies. Thank you, Connor.
Thank you, Nick. Right. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to the Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. We hope you enjoyed this walk through the universe. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter as the Queen's University Observatory to stay up to date. If you like this podcast, you can help us by leaving a review and sharing it with your friends. This will help us become more visible and spread the wonders of the universe to more people. That is all from us.